Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Wednesday, the 26th of December, 2012, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. This is episode 58 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality, and we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each show we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to interview a real-life celebrity. In fact, he's the world's second most famous gay skeptic. Yes, dear listener, DJ Grothy, the president of the James Randi Educational Foundation, will be here in the Joy Studios to talk about the intersection of skepticism and issues pertaining to the LGBT community. Then, in our movie review, we'll have a look at three very different films, but each one interesting in its own right. Safety Not Guaranteed, Samsara, and Searching for Sugar Man. So for all that and more, stay tuned here to Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Now, just before we launch into our LGBT news roundup, a quick message to all our beloved listeners who happen to live in the Federal Electoral Division of Melbourne Ports, which goes from Port Melbourne down through St Kilda and across to Caulfield. Unfortunately, when marriage equality was voted on in the Australian Parliament in September this year, the member for Melbourne Ports, Michael Danby of the ALP, chose to abstain. So, Reality Check has been involved in the formation of an action group called Melbourne Ports Residents for Marriage Equality, set up with the aim of trying to convince Michael Danby to vote yes next time the bill comes before Parliament. So, dear listener, if you happen to live in Melbourne Ports and want to join the campaign, then please go to our Facebook page called Melbourne Ports Residents for Marriage Equality and click like. And if your friends live in Melbourne Ports, please tell them about it. You'll be doing your bit to help make the world a slightly better place, which is what we're all about here on Reality Check. Now, on to our LGBT news roundup, covering all the time since the last episode of Reality Check back on October 18th. So that's covering the last 2 months, basically. And what a momentous 2 months it's been. In fact, quite possibly the most momentous 2 months ever in the history of LGBT rights. So many places got marriage equality over such a short period of time. That, dear listener, has never happened before. So, where do we start? Well, let's start with the biggest news of these last 2 months, and that's the very exciting developments in Brazil. What's that, dear listener? Oh, you thought I was going to say the United States. Well, yeah, I thought that was going to be the biggest story of the last couple of months as well. until things really started popping in Brazil over these last few weeks. And it wouldn't surprise me at all, dear listener, if in fact you haven't actually heard about what's been happening in Brazil, because for some strange reason, the world's media completely ignores what's going on there. But don't worry, I mean, that's why you listen to Reality Check after all, to give you a complete and well-rounded picture of reality. So, the situation in Brazil is that same-sex couples all over the country can get married, but it's a two-step process. First, they have to go to the registry office to get what's called a stable union. Then they need to go before a judge to convert that into a civil marriage. In January this year, the state of Alagoas in the northeast abolished this two-step process and said, okay, same-sex couples can just get married directly in the registry office. But it was the only state to do that. Until a few weeks ago, that is, when suddenly things started changing rapidly. First of all, in the state of Bahia, the court administration ordered that same-sex couples should be able to get married in registry offices throughout the state starting from November 26th. Then, on December 11th, the court administration in the state of Piauí in the northeast also announced that early in 2013, it too is going to end this two-step system and let same-sex couples get married directly in the registry offices. And then, the biggest news of all, on the 18th of December, the state of São Paulo announced that in 60 days' time, all registry offices throughout the state will be required to perform same-sex marriages. This is amazing news, especially Bahia and São Paulo. Bahia is Brazil's fourth most populous state with 14 million people. And São Paulo is Brazil's most populous state with 41 million people. In fact, São Paulo alone is now the third largest jurisdiction ever to get marriage equality. Only South Africa and Spain have higher populations. And if you put it together with Bahia and Piauí, suddenly 58 million people live in states in Brazil that just achieved marriage equality over the last few weeks. Now that has never happened before. Never have so many people gotten marriage equality so quickly. And I'm still just talking about Brazil. I haven't even started talking about what's been happening in the rest of the world yet. So, whichever way you look at it, very, very exciting developments there from Brazil. It seems that all of a sudden, the states of Brazil are starting to fall like dominoes. Let's hope it won't be too long before all 26 states plus the federal district have full marriage equality available in just one step, direct at the registry office. I hope so. But in the meantime, we say a massive parabéns to all our listeners in Bahia, Piauí and São Paulo. Parabéns pra vocês. Okay, let's stay in Latin America for more exciting news, but let's move south to Uruguay, where in the early hours of Wednesday, December 12th, the lower house of the Uruguayan General Assembly, which is basically its parliament, voted 81-6 in favor of a bill to introduce marriage equality. Yes, dear listener, 81 out of 87 members of the lower house voted in favour. That's 93% of MPs. Incredible. The bill now moves to the Senate to be voted on in the next few hours. Yes, today, December 26th, it's going to be voted on. And sources say that it will sail easily through the Senate and be signed into law by the president early next year. The president has in fact already said that he'll sign it. So it's now looking highly likely that Uruguay is going to become the next country in the world to allow marriage equality at the national level. Very exciting. Actually, interesting factoid here, dear listener. Did you know that Uruguay's president, José Mujica, is an atheist and a vegetarian? He has a very austere and humble life, apparently, lives on a farm, drives an old Volkswagen Beetle, and donates 90% of his monthly salary to charity. Sounds like a great guy. He probably listens to Reality Check. So, hola, Jose, just in case you're listening. Okay, let's head north now to Mexico, where the good news from Latin America continues, because on December 5th, the Mexican Supreme Court ruled unanimously that the civil code of the state of Oaxaca, defining marriage as between a man and a woman, is unconstitutional, and it should be changed to allow two people to marry regardless of gender. Which is incredibly good news. However, apparently in Mexican jurisprudence, that's not enough yet to actually change the law. There have to be two more cases from Oaxaca decided by the court in the same way for a precedent to be set and for the current discriminatory law to be overturned. And even if that happens, it will only be overturned in Oaxaca, not for the country as a whole. But still, it's a pretty good start. And obviously, if Oaxaca's law is unconstitutional, then so are the laws in the 30 other states that currently prevent same-sex marriage. I guess those laws will just have to be challenged in the courts as well. Now, same-sex marriage is already legal in Mexico City and in the state of Quintana Roo. And hopefully this is the first step in the process of its spread throughout the country. Encouragingly, after the Supreme Court decision, several members of the State Congress of Oaxaca announced that they intend to change the law to allow same-sex couples to marry. So hopefully they'll do that soon, so this won't have to be litigated twice more. Whatever happens, dear listener, we will, of course, keep you informed of developments here on Reality Check. And still in Latin America, let's take a quick peek at Colombia, because Colombia seems to be moving in the direction of marriage equality as well, although it's far from clear how the process is going to turn out there. Now, the Constitutional Court of Colombia ruled in July 2011 that the Congress had to legislate for marriage equality within 2 years, or the court will do it for them. Well, that 2-year deadline is now fast approaching, and the Congress is beginning to finally get its act into gear. So on December 4th, a Senate committee approved a bill to allow same-sex marriage. Now, that still has to get through the Congress, obviously, but things are definitely moving in a positive direction in Colombia so far. So, Latin America is just surging ahead. Brazil, Uruguay, Mexico, Colombia. I told you, dear listener, that these last 2 months had been the most momentous ever for LGBT rights. And we haven't even got to the United States yet. So let's go there now.
Tonight, because of the work of everyone in this room and so many staff and volunteers and supporters all over the country, we have finally won.
That expression of pure joy there from the state of Maine expressed pretty much how all Reality Check listeners were feeling when they woke up on November 7th, after the most momentous day for LGBT rights in the history of the United States. November 6, 2012 will go down in history as a turning point for LGBT rights in the US. So, where do we start with this massive story? Well, let's start with the 3 ballot initiatives that, for the first time ever in the history of the world, saw marriage equality introduced through the popular vote. That's right, dear listener, same-sex marriage had never anywhere in the world been approved at a referendum by the voters. Never, that is, until November 6th, when it was approved in 3 US states, Maine, Maryland, and Washington. And maybe the sweetest victory of those three was Maine. Because in Maryland and Washington, marriage equality was put on the ballot by our opponents. They wanted to use the ballot to stop it. Same-sex marriage had been passed by the legislatures and signed by the governors in both those states, but then the right wing gathered enough signatures to block the bills and put them to a popular vote. So how did that work out for you guys? Oh, not too well, it seems, because we won and they lost in both Washington and Maryland. But in Maine, it wasn't the opponents of same-sex marriage who were trying to block a bill through a ballot. It was our side who brought the issue to a ballot. It was a proactive initiative of marriage equality supporters who asked the voters to approve. And they won. It was the first time ever that proponents of marriage equality had put the issue in a ballot initiative. And first time lucky, they won. So it really paid off. And what's even more interesting is that back in November 2009, as we reported here on Reality Check at the time, marriage equality was put to the ballot in Maine and lost. So now, just 3 years later, it was back on the ballot and won. So that just goes to prove, as we always say here on Reality Check, that we are indeed living through historic times, dear listener, because in those 3 years, we reached a tipping point. Now, we can win full equality at the ballot box, at least in some parts of the world. Now you can see why we're so excited here at Reality Check. Now, the other win we had on November 6th was in Minnesota, where the right wing brought a ballot initiative to try to introduce a constitutional amendment to ban marriage equality in the Minnesota Constitution. And they lost. The amendment was not approved. So we didn't actually achieve marriage equality, but we prevented a step from being taken in the wrong direction, at least. Which is also historic, because until now, 32 states have had similar referenda to prohibit same-sex marriage in their constitutions, and they've always won. Until now. Because suddenly, everything is changing. So that's another historic result that hopefully puts the brakes on that nasty trend of constitutional amendments. And not only puts the brakes on, but I think turns the train around now completely and starts to move it in the other direction. And that's why I think the right wing is probably feeling pretty scared right now, because it's pretty obvious which way the train is headed now. And it's also pretty obvious that the train is now unstoppable. Maybe they can throw a bit of dirt on the tracks to slow it down, but they certainly won't be able to stop it from now on. So, just to keep a tally of the score so far, with the addition of Maine, Maryland, and Washington, that brings the total to 10 jurisdictions in the United States that now allow same-sex marriage. That's 9 states plus Washington, D.C. So, those are the marriage referenda. Now, the other great news from November 6th, obviously, is that Obama was re-elected. But particularly that he was re-elected having already declared his support for full marriage equality last May. He didn't wait until his second term, he did it in his first term, and still got elected. Again, dear listener, this is historic. A US president can get elected while supporting marriage equality. What exciting times we do live in. Finally, the other bit of exciting news from the US elections was that Tammy Baldwin, a lesbian, was elected to the US Senate, making her the first ever openly LGB or T senator in US history. Interestingly, there are now 7 openly LGBT members of Congress, 6 in the House of Reps, and 1 in the Senate. A record number. Okay, so that's it for the US elections, but let's just stay in the United States a little bit longer for one further news update from there, and that is that on December 7th, the US Supreme Court decided that it will take two cases dealing with marriage equality. Now, this will be the first time it's ever dealt directly with the issue of same-sex marriage. So it's going to hear one of the DOMA cases, that is one of the cases challenging the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, and it's also going to hear the Prop 8 case, that's challenging the constitutionality of Proposition 8, which was the California ballot measure that amended the California Constitution in order to ban same-sex marriage. So everyone's holding their breath to see what happens. Although don't hold your breath too long because decisions on both cases are not expected until late June next year, just when all the big pride marches are taking place. Should be interesting. The permutations and combinations for how these two cases could turn out are almost endless because the court is not only going to look at the substantive issues, the merits of each case, but also the standing of the parties to even lodge the appeals in the first place, given that in both cases, the original defendants, that is the state of California in Prop 8 and the Federal Justice Department in DOMA, both those original defendants effectively conceded and withdrew. And the right wing then stepped in both cases to take their place. Anyway, they'll both be important and historic decisions when they come, and we will, of course, be reporting on them here on Reality Check. Finally, our last marriage equality story for today is that on December 4th, the first same-sex marriage ever on a Caribbean island took place on the tiny island of Saba, which is what's called a special municipality of the Netherlands. Now, the marriage could take place there because the Dutch marriage equality law was extended there in October. Saba only has a population of about 2,000 people, but apparently LGBT tourism is expected to soar there over the coming months, as same-sex couples head there for their tropical island weddings. So congratulations to the little Caribbean island of Saba. Now, there is lots more marriage news happening, particularly as France and the UK and New Zealand continue to advance rapidly towards marriage equality. But we're running out of time here today on Reality Check, so let's just jump into our final story. And to do that, let's come home to Australia, where at long last, after many years, there's finally some movement on bringing in a federal anti-discrimination law. A Senate committee is now looking at a draft of a bill called the Human Rights and Anti-Discrimination Bill. The aim of the bill is to consolidate the existing anti-discrimination laws into one comprehensive act. So basically, it would cover the existing categories of race, sex, age, and disability, and would add the new categories of sexual orientation and gender identity. Which is all well and good. The only thing we're slightly concerned about here at Reality Check is, hasn't the government left this until quite late in its second term? I mean, will the bill be enacted before next year's federal election? And if there's a change of government, what will happen then? The coalition has previously said that they support it in principle, but given that when in office they've never done anything for LGBT rights, well, frankly, things don't look very hopeful. Anyway, whatever happens, dear listener, you'll be sure to hear about it here on Reality Check. And that brings us to the end of our LGBT news roundup for the last few weeks. Let's take a quick break now and listen to a song. And when we come back, we'll have a chat with celebrity gay skeptic DJ Grothy. Yes, he's gay, he's a skeptic, and he's a celebrity. So don't go away. Much more exciting Reality Check coming up here on Joy 94.9.
Come with us as we take you to all new heights. Joy
94.9. Hey, this is Winter Gordon, and you're listening to Joy 94.9, Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Umkomboti by Yvonne Chaka Chaka from 1988. And I played that song because an event was held at the UN in New York on December 11th to call for respect for LGBT rights around the world. And the main panel included Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, Ricky Martin, and Yvonne Chaka Chaka. Apparently, she's a great advocate for LGBT rights. So good on you, Yvonne. And once again, Ban Ki-moon continues to show that he's loudly and clearly one of the greatest advocates for the human rights of LGBT people in the world. And I think he deserves a lot of admiration for that. Okay, we now move into the part of the show where we normally undertake a skeptical analysis of a subject related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. But today we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to interview a real-life celebrity. Yes, dear listener, we're going to have a chat with the second most famous gay skeptic in the world, DJ Grothy. Now, the world's most famous gay skeptic is, of course, James Randi, who, as it turns out, is actually DJ Grothy's boss, because DJ is the president of the James Randi Educational Foundation. Both Randi and DJ were in Melbourne in early December for the Australian Skeptics National Convention. So here at Reality Check, the world's one and only LGBT skeptical radio show and podcast, we couldn't resist inviting DJ Grothy into the studios here at Joy 94.9 for a quick chat about the intersection of LGBT issues and skepticism. Is there even an intersection between these two fields? Do they ever overlap? Well, that's what I wanted to find out. I started by asking DJ about his upbringing and his process of evolution into the celebrity gay skeptic that he is today.
When I was a teenager, I was a religious seeker, sort of a spiritual seeker. And when I was 14, three things happened the same year. One, I joined what in retrospect was a cult. Sociologists of religion would consider it a cult called the Worldwide Church of God. I came out as gay, and I also started getting into conjuring magic. So performance magic, like, magicians doing magic tricks. All three of those happened at the same time.
Okay, so you joined a cult and came out as gay at the same time.
Right.
That's interesting. Right. All right.
Which meant I went back in quite quickly, right?
Okay.
So when I joined this church, sort of arch fundamentalist church, of course, being gay is not a good thing. And I believed for years of my teenage life that being gay was sort of my struggle. It's something that I needed to overcome. Everyone has something to overcome. Mine just happens to be that I am gay, right?
This is from the teachings of the cult, basically, of the church.
Right. And, you know, it wasn't unique. Really, many mainline religious traditions also teach some variation of that. I mean, even the Dalai Lama has said being gay is bad, right?
Yeah.
And I tend to like what he says about most everything else. So it's not a unique view. And as a teenager, I joined a version of Exodus International. It was a sort of Lutheran version of Exodus International, where you try to ungay yourself through group counseling and sort of religious / psychological intervention, right?
Right. So Exodus is one of these so-called ex-gay conversion.
Exactly. It's a reparative therapy or conversion therapy.
Right.
Quackery, pseudoscientific, harmful, dangerous, reprehensible movement in, you don't even want to say it's in psychology because it's been so repudiated by mainstream psychological sciences. But so I was involved with that, and I remember, you know, as I got more involved in the church, I mean, it sounds sort of reductionistic to say I tried to pray away the gay, but I was very religious and tried to make sense out of my sexuality in terms of that religious conviction and commitment. And I eventually went away to the church's Bible college, at which I got, I think, a good little liberal arts education. And Diderot has this great line, the Enlightenment philosophe, he says, "There's nothing like a good Jesuit education to make you an atheist." Well, I got a liberal arts education, and I became sort of a religious skeptic at Bible college. And with that skepticism came a sort of maturing of my self-acceptance as a gay man and all of that stuff.
Okay, wait, hang on. Religious skeptic, what's that?
A person who's skeptic of religion. That I guess, oh, okay. In the States, I guess that's one of the ways you describe that. So atheist, agnostic, something along those
lines. Okay, so
right?
You became a religious skeptic while at Bible college.
Exactly.
Through your studies of the Bible or something.
And of the history of the Western intellectual tradition, all of that stuff. Okay. I don't think you could be well educated and be a fundamentalist. Now, all my currently fundamentalist friends are going to take umbrage at that, but still, I'll say it. And so at Bible college, I remember my freshman year still being all wrapped up in how bad gay is, and coming out to, you know, the president of the college and a professor and some friends in the dorm, and everyone was wrapped up and helping me with the struggle, and it was quite melodramatic and appealed to all my grandiosities and all that stuff. But then you sort of mature out of that. You realize, oh, get real. Look at Western culture. Look at, you know, our species. Being gay is sort of natural, normal. So with my skepticism came a sort of acceptance of being gay. And I had gone through some cycles of acceptance and rejection and all of that stuff, self-acceptance, self-rejection, throughout my teen years. So I remember, you know, at 16 or 17, joining a group in St. Louis called Growing American Youth, GAY, the acronym, you know, it's a teenage gay group.
Okay.
And then feeling horribly guilty about it and, you know, vowing never to go again and, you know, getting more involved in my church. And so I had those sorts of struggles. But I draw a line from my becoming skeptical to becoming more accepting, or completely accepting, really, of my sexuality, seeing it as something natural and just one of the manifold ways people do their thing.
Was your family particularly homophobic?
No, not at all. In fact, it was a much bigger deal to my family for me to reveal my skepticism about the supernatural, about God, than it was to come out when I was a teenager. So When I came out as a teenager, my parents and you know, my friends, everybody was very accepting, and I was the one who wasn't. I was the one who took the Bible literally and vowed to overcome it and all of that stuff, right? It was much harder, as an example, for my grandmother to accept that I didn't believe in God than that I was gay. And she's a different sort of fundamentalist. So I think it's because there's more of an existential threat when someone you love says, "I don't believe in heaven or hell or your central beliefs." If instead they say, "Oh, I'm a sinner and I'm gay," you could sort of live with it. Maybe God will forgive them. Maybe someone's going to hell. But that doesn't really shake up the foundational beliefs that they have. At least in my experience, it was a bigger deal to be a skeptic, a religious skeptic, than to be gay.
And then in your professional life, you basically became a professional skeptic. So tell us about that.
That's right. Well, in Bible college, I was in a course where a professor used a textbook that taught the religious worldviews of the day. And this just shows you the sort of anti-intellectualism in some fundamentalist strains of American Christianity. But this textbook basically reduced every worldview to four. There were only four. There was biblical Christianity. There was Marxism. There was something called secular humanism. And then there was the New Age, right? So everything fit in those four categories. And as I'm reading this textbook, it mentions a couple magazines in the secular humanism sections. It mentioned Free Inquiry magazine, Skeptical Inquiry magazine, and it turned out that the school's library subscribed to those. So I started reading them on a know thy enemy basis, and doggone it, I read this atheism, the secular humanism stuff, it sort of clicks.
And you converted to the enemy, you changed sides.
Exactly. And after Bible college, I went off to grad school and St. Louis, Washington University, and interned with the publisher of those magazines, Center for Inquiry, and eventually took a job with them, and I was with them for a good 10 years before I moved to a peer organization of the Center for Inquiry called the James Randi Educational Foundation. It's this international nonprofit that is founded by the public intellectual and the magician, James Randi, whom I knew years before as a magician when I was a teenager reading magic magazines and involved in the magic club. So there's an interesting sort of connection between all of these things and being skeptical of religion. And then really, you know, maybe I was an evangelist, wanted to share the good news of religion when I bought that. Now I'm a skeptic, but I still think it's pretty damn good news. And I want to apply my energies to getting the word out.
Now let's talk a little bit about James Randi, your boss, your current boss. He is quite possibly the world's most famous skeptic. He's come up against a lot of, shall we say, charlatans like Uri Geller, Sylvia Brown, Peter Popoff, John Edward, a whole range of people who claim to be psychics and spoon benders, as Uri Geller claims. Tell us a bit about Randi, and particularly an important revelation that he made about 2 years ago.
Right. So Randi is really unique in the history of 20th century skepticism, 21st century skepticism, because here he was for decades a really prominent magician, influential in the community of magicians, right? He traveled the world, he was a successful, famous magician. But for decades, he used his background in magic also to puncture the pretensions of those people who would beguile audiences by using magic, but pretending that it was real. Hucksters and charlatans who would swindle people by cheating them into thinking they had supernatural powers. Randi, as a magician, would see this and not just say, oh, to each his own, but he'd really get riled up. He has this sort of righteous indignation where he wants to fight people who take advantage of other people. It's skepticism in the public interest. So from an early age, Randy's been involved in that project. When he was 60 years old, he retired as a professional magician, and he's devoted all these decades since, he's now in his mid-80s, to advancing the skeptical, the pro-science point of view, because undue credulity in the supernatural, he thinks, and we think at the foundation, it harms people. And so he has worked for all these decades to advance critical thinking about that in order to help people avoid that harm. You mentioned that he's gone after some of these prominent, these celebrity psychics and these major charlatans. If you were going to ask someone who's steeped in this subculture of skepticism, right? It's sort of a growing worldwide movement. What are the top 10 instances of great skepticism the last 100 years? Randi is involved with what? All of them, right?
Yeah.
He exposed the TV preacher Peter Popoff, one of these faith healers, you know, stand in front of a congregation and call out to the audience and say very impressively specific things about parishioners' lives, you know, the address they live at or what their ailment is, and people cry and feel very emotional. Well, it took Randi to show up at one of these faith healing crusades with a receiver, with an FM receiver, to record the fact that Peter Popoff's wife was backstage feeding him information through an earpiece about parishioners' ailments. And Randi exposed that on national television of the United States. And time and again, he really alone has gone out there and exposed these charlatans who take advantage of people. It's inspiring to work with him, and the whole team at the JREF, and everyone who supports the little foundation, the James Randi Educational Foundation. We are inspired by the work Randi continues to do. In fact, what we're in Melbourne, Randy's been traveling the world the past few years, speaking about these things, educating the public about this. We just returned from India for 10 days. He's been lecturing throughout Australia here in Melbourne. And so that's a little about Randi. You mentioned a few years ago, well, it wasn't a surprise to anyone close to him because Randi had never been in the closet. He was just never very out of the closet, if you understand maybe the balancing effort there. He came out as gay when he was 81 years old.
Yeah.
And people found that really inspiring. I remember the magician and the skeptic Penn Jillette. Randi came out on what was my radio show at the time, and Penn Jillette said, you know, reading the blog post or listening to that stuff, it made him tear up, made him bawl, because how beautiful Randy's story was. You know, he didn't want being gay to distract from that important work. On the other hand, he didn't want being gay to be something that needed to be kept secret. And so that's why even at 81, he came out.
Yeah, I think it's interesting reading Randy's coming out story that he was inspired to come out by seeing the movie Milk.
Exactly. He saw that and it sort of clicked. He was like, well, you know, everyone close to him already knew that he was gay, but it wasn't part of the public story. And I think because a couple few decades ago, the fact that Randy was gay could have been used by his cultural competitors. A psychic that Randy exposed might be able to stick it to Randy by saying, well, yes, okay, maybe I'm fake, but you're gay, you know? And so maybe there was some of that going on, some of that tension or concern. But Randy hopscotched over that, came out at 81, and, you know, just keeps on trucking.
Yeah, he certainly does. He's 84 now, and he's sprightly and extremely active, I have
right,
to say.
Right, right.
Now let's look a bit at the overlap between skepticism and LGBT rights, those two communities, largely separate, but there are overlapping people who overlap in both those communities. What is the overlap there?
Well, I think skepticism, the sort of method of inquiry that I'm talking about, benefits everyone and it is for everyone. That means LGBT folks included. I don't think that the sort of scientific skepticism I'm talking about necessarily implies some social justice agenda, because if you're just evaluating this claim about ghosts or the Loch Ness Monster or UFOs, it doesn't follow that, oh, you also have to believe in this or that social program. It is true, however, that I'd say the vast majority of folks who live their lives in an evidence-based way are not going to buy into the junk beliefs of people who push agendas that are anti-gay, because their reasoning is often based on really bad evidence. Evidence like lesbians and gays harm society because, and you know, fill in the blanks, it's just not borne out by the social science. Or you'll read some polemicists, anti-gay folks who argue that gay parents raise damaged children. It's just not borne out by the social science. So skepticism has something to say to the LGBT world in that way. It's a defender of the science that supports pro-gay stances and stands as against the junk science that ideologues use against gays, if you follow what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, the skeptical community is a natural ally, in a way, with the LGBT community.
I think so. That's how I see it. That's not to say that gay rights is the agenda of the skeptic, but just as I might be an advocate of animal rights or of civil rights or equality for the sexes, but not draw a direct line from skepticism to that social agenda. But there's still junk science used by our cultural competitors against all of those racial and sexual minorities that scientific skepticism can get at and debunk.
Right. And in a way, we are often facing the same cultural competitor, as you say, which is often the religious right.
Right. The religious right advances an ideology, a religious political extremism, that they rarely say their faith is good enough to support. Sometimes you'll find a religious right ideologues, you know, to say, oh, the Bible says, and therefore I believe. But you often find a religious right ideologue say, well, the Bible says being gay is wrong, but so does this pseudoscientific quack, you know, this academic who happens to have an agenda. And it's when people marshal bad evidence that the scientific skeptic can get involved. Bad evidence like, or junk science like reparative therapy, that you can go through some psychological process and turn straight. Well, there's no evidence that that works, and there's a lot of evidence that that quackery really harms people, really harms people. And the scientific skeptic has something to say about that.
Right, and then they'll also make other ridiculous claims, such as the Pope talking about the tiny holes in condoms that allow HIV to pass through.
Right, that's pseudoscientific. It's junk science. Or views about why people are gay, right? Mm. Or, look, science has a story about how gay people got here, right? And maybe even there's some debate, right, in the secular world about that. But non-scientific ways of thinking have completely opposite explanations that you can get at with science and debunk, sort of rail against in a reasoned way. So not railing, but examining and dismissing for lack of good evidence. When someone says being gay is wrong because it's unnatural, that's a claim that we can examine by looking at the evidence. Well, is it unnatural? No. In fact, it's natural because it's found in the natural world, in the animal kingdom widely.
In every species,
in,
I think.
In just about every social species, yeah. And some not-so-social species. Right. You know, cranes, you might have gay coupling of cranes for life. Now, it's not the same sort of gay that gay and lesbian people are gay, right? But just like, you know, heterosexual coupling in animals, it's not exactly the same. There is some cultural component of being gay, and that's an interesting other discussion, I'll concede. But also within the LGBT world, there's a lot of nonsense belief that harms gays and lesbians. There are a whole host, at least in the United States, and I'll bet you a round of drinks it's the same here in Australia, there are a whole host of pseudoscientific and complementary and alternative medicine beliefs that aren't founded in science-based medicine that are advanced in the LGBT world to help with various LGBT concerns. So I've seen quackery pushed regarding, you know, AIDS cures. It's junk science. It's quackery, harmful stuff. It's akin to, you know, the psychic surgeons in the Philippines who said they would heal people of their cancer by essentially just doing sleight of hand with pig guts, pretending to remove diseased organs from people's bodies without an incision. Well, as harmful as that is, if you have cancer and you go to a psychic surgeon, you will die, like Andy Kaufman, the great American comedian, did, or like Peter Sellers did when he had cancer. They didn't go to oncologists, they went to psychic surgeons. Well, if you have health concerns as a gay man and you don't go to a medical scientist and instead you go to some Reiki practitioner or some holistic health practitioner, or you'd use homeopathy or some other quackery, you're going to be harmed. So skepticism in that way, I think, has something to say to the LGBT community.
Do you think,
I think that's an example.
Do you think that the LGBT community is perhaps more susceptible, or the level of beliefs in some of these pseudoscientific subjects is higher in the LGBT community than the general community?
That's just a really interesting question, something I've thought about a lot in the United States. So one big puzzle is, why in the world are there these gay people who are religious? Okay, so I don't want to be too antagonistic to religious folks. Some of my best friends are religious, I'll say that. But it seems to me that when you're gay and you want the approval or the acceptance of the church, it's at least metaphorically, or it's analogous to being a black person trying to join the KKK or something like that. Now, that's a, you know, overstated to make a point. I remember at the Matthew Shepard Symposium on Social Justice a few years ago where I was speaking, I made that point, and half the audience strongly agreed, and half the audience, my gosh, it was, you know, it was fisticuffs. So that's a minority of gay people who want mainline religion and traditional religion, not only to accept them, but for them to join and be part of all that. Instead, I think there's a wider group of LGBT folks who reject traditional religion. It stands to reason. Traditional religion has not offered them much. In fact, it's made their lives living hells. You know, even Rick Warren, the evangelical minister in the United States, runs one of these big mega churches. He's very influential. He just almost conceded yesterday. He said, look, I think the church is responsible for a lot of negative gay opinions. Okay, so admit that and change it. That's our response. As gay activists, you know, in the sideline. So when you reject traditional religion as a gay person, as a lesbian, but you're not going to say, oh, science accept me, because science really isn't some subculture of meets once a week and, you know, loves on you. You might turn to alternative views like the New Age or some of those things. I think LGBT people are especially susceptible to New Age quackery and falderal. Things like The Secret, you know, this new thought view that says, if you have anything negative in your life, you're responsible for it because of the thinking that you've brought into the universe that manifests itself in reality. Now, that's a reprehensible doctrine. It's vile and ugly because it basically says the poor person, the homeless person, they deserve it because they don't have the right thought patterns. Or the gay person who might be miserable on this or that account, not certainly because he or she's gay or lesbian, but you know, whatever, bad life choices, they deserve it. All they need is this palliative of New Age thinking.
Not only is it reprehensible, it's demonstrably untrue.
Exactly. So skeptics care about what's true, not only because it's true, but because believing false things hurt you. It's bad for your health, your mental health, your physical health. So it's demonstrably untrue to think that nonsense. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of LGBT folks buy into that sort of stuff, almost as a reaction against traditional religion.
Right. So it's almost like in somehow maybe losing that form of community with the religion, they seek community, if you like,
right,
in other fields. Some of those could be dangerous in the New Age area.
And that's why I like to, in Los Angeles there, I like to tell my gay and lesbian folks, hey, you know, there is a really accepting pro-science community called skepticism, you know, mm-hmm. and they get together and they hang out and they love on each other. We're social primates. We enjoy one another's company, skeptics in the pub, gatherings, whatever. And a gay person shows up at a skeptics powwow, you're going to be accepted and, you know, no one will bat an eye.
Also, I think another way of looking at this is that the skeptical community is often on the LGBT side because homophobia, like racism, like sexism, is irrational. It's not based on reality.
Right. It's certainly not evidence-based. And when people have tried to argue that it's evidence-based by using pseudoscience, it's been the pro-science community, the skeptics, who come in and dig in and expose really how it's junk science. You know, there are quack theories why women are inferior to men, or junk science theories for why black people are inferior to white people. So science isn't blameless in this, but the good news about science is that it's self-correcting and that there's a community of scientists and pro-science folks who are constantly looking at consensus views and trying to pick them apart in a sort of self-improvement project. You don't get that from religion. I guess in some religions there's a steady march of progress, but that's not coming from the religion. That's really coming from outside. You know, when a liberal religionist says, I'm not going to take my Bible really seriously because if I did, I'd be a bad person, right? So instead, I'm going to buy into the steady march of social progress, you know, equal rights for everybody. It's not easy to get that from the Bible.
Now, one other kind of similarity that I can see, or at least a similar metaphor that exists from the LGBT community to particularly the atheist community, is that atheists often describe themselves as coming out in a similar way. What's your opinion on that?
The Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, a close ally and friend of the James Randi Educational Foundation, they've launched something called the Out Campaign. And it's not for gays and lesbians to come out, transgendered folks and bisexual folks to come out. No, it's for atheists to come out because it's a project to raise awareness about this vast swath of people who lack belief in God, but they're your neighbors, they're your friends, and they've just sort of kept quiet about it. So that's a worthy project that we get really behind. We really care about that project, even though the James Randi Educational Foundation is not itself an atheist organization. So I see that similarity. I've also cautioned some of my atheist activist buddies to not draw the analogy too strongly, because I think that, at least in the United States, I think a lot of places around the world, being a lesbian or a gay or a bisexual or a transgender person, you face diminished life prospects that far exceed the diminished life prospects of an atheist or other sexual minorities or racial minorities. For an atheist to say civil rights brought equality to black people. The feminist movement brought equality to women. The gay rights movement brought equality to gays. They've all had their day in the sun. Now it's atheists' turn. Well, it's just that's too strong of an analogy because atheists don't face the same level of discrimination that racial and sexual minorities do. That said, atheism is terribly unpopular in many quarters. Now, I think it's getting more popular. This is a great time to be an atheist and a skeptic of the supernatural. But I wouldn't draw the analogy too strong. I think that atheism is not a civil rights issue in the same exact way that being gay or being black or being a woman is, although there are some civil rights issues related to it. You know, you could be fired for being an atheist. But the level of discrimination atheists face, I think, is not equally on par with gays, black folk, women, etc. You know, being an atheist is unpopular, but so is like being a Satanist, right? Or so is being a Buddhist, right? You know, you're not going to imagine a Buddhist president successfully running for office, but that doesn't mean Buddhists should be in the street demanding their civil rights. They already have their civil rights. Atheists already have their civil rights. When they are infringed, we should fight to protect them. But it's not like African Americans working for the right to vote or women working for the right to vote. Atheists already have those civil rights. We just need to protect them.
Right, yeah. I can't think of any example of a legal right that an atheist doesn't have, whereas there are clear examples of legal rights that LGBT
atheists,
people don't have.
Straight atheists can get married, for instance, you know. Now, atheists might have a beef because maybe there's a social pressure to get married in a church. But in Europe, you know, almost nobody gets married in a church, gay or straight. You get civil unions. It's increasingly less taboo to be secular, atheist, skeptical, whatever. But the work certainly isn't done, even if that non-belief group, the nuns, as they've been called, is growing. It's gone from 8%. Now it's 14.5%. It's the largest, would you say, belief group behind, I think, one of the mainline religious traditions, Catholicism, say, in the United States. Now, they're not cohered as one self-identified group like Catholics. So there's a lot more organizing to do.
And it is the fastest growing, I think.
Right, right. I think there are a lot of factors that explain that. But one is that, my gosh, this is the best time to be alive as a scientist. There are discoveries every day, and the more that science marches forward, the less room there is for superstitious belief. At least that's my faith claim, and I'm sticking to it.
DJ Grothy, thank you very much for speaking to us at Reality Check.
Tony, fantastic conversation. I appreciate being on the show.
Well, there you have it, dear listener. Words of wisdom from the president of the James Randi Educational Foundation and all-round nice guy, DJ Grothy. Now, if you'd like more information about the foundation, just visit their website at randi.org. That's randi.org. You can also visit their page on YouTube, which is at youtube.com/JamesRandiFoundation. Now, before we go to a song, if you'd like to send in your opinions or a comment or question on today's topic or an idea for a future topic, please send us an email. The address is realitychecktony, that's T-O-N-Y, @gmail.com. You can also visit our webpage too for past episodes of Reality Check. That's at realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie reviews.
Melbourne's biggest gay voice has a fresh new sound.
Fresh new sound.
Joy 94.9.
Done before, giving substance to shadows, giving substance evermore.
Hi, this is Sam Sparrow, and you're listening to Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The song you just heard there was Crucify Your Mind by Rodriguez, released in 1970. And the reason I played that song should become apparent fairly soon. It's movie review time here on Reality Check, and the three movies up for review today are Safety Not Guaranteed, Samsara, and Searching for Sugar Man. Let's begin with Safety Not Guaranteed. This is a new independent American comedy drama from first-time director Colin Trevorrow. It was inspired by a real-life ad that appeared in the classifieds of Backwoods Home magazine in 1997. The ad reads like this. Wanted. Somebody to go back in time with me. This is not a joke. You'll get paid after we get back. Must bring your own weapons. Safety not guaranteed. I have only done this once before. As it turned out, this ad was actually written by one of the employees at the magazine to fill in some leftover space in the classified section. But it became somewhat legendary, particularly on the internet, and served as the inspiration for the screenwriter of Safety Not Guaranteed. So, judging from the premise, Safety Not Guaranteed would appear to be a time travel movie. And here on Reality Check, time travel movies are one of our favourite subgenres. In fact, in our last episode, we reviewed another time travel movie, Looper, which was a little bit disappointing. Safety Not Guaranteed is, however, a much better pick, in my opinion. But actually, I don't want to spoil the plot too much by even saying that it's a time travel movie. So let's just say Safety Not Guaranteed is about time travel and may or may not itself involve time travel. And let's just leave it at that. Now, this film is one of those low-budget American independent films of which there have been quite a few very interesting ones over the last couple of years. For example, Take Shelter was one of my top three favourite films of 2011. That was a low-budget film too. But Safety Not Guaranteed is ultra-low-budget, made for less than $1 million. And I have to confess, dear listener, during the first 10 minutes of this movie, I was really wondering what we were in for and why they were even showing it commercially in a cinema. It looks like a student film. The image quality is terrible, especially for the scenes shot in low light. And some of the editing is just really clunky. But I'm happy to say that this film, as the story develops, grows on you. And in fact, by the end, I really enjoyed it a lot. Which just goes to show that what really makes a film work is not hundreds of millions of dollars spent on special effects. In fact, most of the time, that makes for a boring movie. What really makes a film work is simple. A good story with good actors and sympathetic characters. That's pretty much it. In my opinion, the purpose of cinema is to move you, to give the audience an emotional experience for 90 minutes. And Safety Not Guaranteed achieves that very effectively, simply through good storytelling. So it comes highly recommended by Reality Check. Now, moving across the entire spectrum of cinema, let's look at a movie that is the polar opposite of Safety Not Guaranteed. Let's look at Samsara. Whereas in Safety Not Guaranteed, the cinematography was terrible, but the plot and characters were great, Samsara is the opposite. There's no plot and no characters. And the movie is pure cinematography and music and nothing else. But what impressive cinematography it is. It contains quite possibly some of the most stunningly beautiful moving images you'll ever see. Samsara is a non-verbal, non-narrative visual extravaganza made by the same duo who produced Baraka back in 1992. So if you've seen Baraka, or any of the so-called katsi films, like Koyanis Katsi or Poa Katsi, then you'll know the type of film I'm talking about. And I'm happy to say, dear listener, just as Safety Not Guaranteed is a great example of what it's possible to achieve at one end of the cinema spectrum, Samsara is a wonderful example of great filmmaking at the complete other end of the spectrum, using only images. Because those images are just so good and so powerful. The film was shot entirely in 70mm film, and the images just look breathtaking, so clear and so sharp. One of the first images of the movie is of clouds of smoke and ash rising out of a volcano, and the clarity is quite extraordinary. Now, these types of movies are often criticized for being all style and no substance, for being just pretty postcards but with nothing else beneath. In fact, I read one critic of Samsara who described it as like a series of lovely screensavers for his computer. But I have to say I disagree. For one thing, there is great pleasure in simply seeing beautiful images. So there's nothing wrong with that. But more than that, what's interesting is what those images depict, the extraordinary scenes they show. A whole series of images of natural beauty juxtaposed with giant cityscapes, extreme poverty and extreme luxury, the brutality of factory farming, production and consumption on a massive scale, extraordinary religious rituals, and so much more. To me, films like Samsara give you a kind of God's eye glimpse of the planet and give you a hint at what it must be like to understand the sheer magnitude of human activity. Now, of course, it's impossible for our human brains to imagine everything that's happening in the world at any one time, but movies like Samsara can give you a tiny glimpse of what it might be like to be able to do that, to see the world as the gods supposedly see it. For example, there are approximately 7 billion people on the planet right now. Now, no human can conceive of that number. If you actually write down the number, you start to get a better idea. If you actually write the 7,000,000,000,000, well, you start to get an idea of the magnitude of that number. But watching films like Samsara is about the closest we can come to ever being able to visualize just the sheer number of humans on the planet and the effect that their activity has. For that reason, I find these movies actually useful. Often when I read news stories about the problem of vast amounts of computer waste or factory farming on massive scales or whatever, the only way I have to try to visualize that problem is by conjuring up images I've seen in films like Samsara or Baraka. Probably the most memorable scenes in Samsara for me were of a massive religious ritual. There were a series of overhead shots taken during the Hajj, the annual pilgrimage to Mecca. Thousands and thousands of pilgrims, all dressed in white, circle around the Kaaba, that giant cube of black granite in the middle of Mecca. Now, the images are absolutely spellbinding and give you a tiny idea of the magnitude of that event and the sheer number of Muslims that go to Mecca every year. In other words, what I'm really trying to say is that films like Samsara are, in my opinion, a kind of non-religious, non-mystical way of having a type of spiritual experience. And something that I think all atheists and freethinkers and reality check listeners could definitely enjoy. Now, very briefly, our final movie up for review today is Searching for Sugar Man. And frankly, I don't want to say too much at all about this film, because the less you know about it, the better. But in a nutshell, it's a documentary about a singer from Detroit in the early 70s called Rodriguez. That was him you heard singing just a few minutes ago. He released a couple of albums, but they didn't go anywhere, so he just disappeared off the scene. However, unbeknownst to him, the albums became hugely successful in the, at that time, isolated pariah state of apartheid-era South Africa. Everyone there had his albums, but they didn't know anything about him. They just presumed that he was a huge international star. But then they heard that he'd killed himself on stage at a concert in the US, and that's pretty much all they knew. So the documentary is basically a search to find out what really happened to Rodriguez. And I'm not going to say much more than that, except that it's really a very good documentary and very uplifting. In fact, at the screening I attended, by the end of the movie, I don't think there was a dry eye in the house. It's a very powerful story and a must-see movie, in my opinion. So, Safety Not Guaranteed, Samsara, and Searching for Sugar Man. Three very different types of films, but at the same time, all excellent examples of the wonderful potential that cinema has to move and inspire audiences. And all three come highly recommended by Reality Check. That brings us to the end of the 58th episode of Reality Check. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com. And visit our website to subscribe to the podcast. That's at realitycheckonline.net. I'll be back with the next episode sometime early in the new year. That will be our Psychic Predictions episode for 2013, so should be a lot of fun. In the meantime, have a happy new year. See you soon.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.